Welcome to my monthly podcast titled Becoming a Sage. My name is Jan Freed, but you can call me Dr. Jan. I interview people about wisdom, how to find meaning on a daily basis, a concept I call breadcrumb legacy. I'm passionate about helping people get from where they are to where they want to be, particularly in the second half of life. I also say I'm out to retire the word retirement. We're not retiring from life, but we're moving on to something else. And I believe it takes time and intentional thought to successfully move on to what's next in life. Today, I'm interviewing Dr. Megan Gerhart. Megan is a professor of management leadership at the Farmer School of Business at Miami University, where she also serves as director of leadership development for the Farmer School and the co-director of the Isaac and Oxley Center for Business Leadership. Megan is the author of the book, Gentelligence, A Revolutionary Approach to Leading an Intergenerational Workforce. In 2017, she gave a TEDx talk, Why I Love Millennials and You Should Too. Now, we're going to discover why she believes that. For more information about Dr. Gerhart, please refer to the bio attached to this podcast. Well, welcome to the series, Becoming a Sage, Dr. Megan.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I've wanted to interview you since reading your book, Gentelligence. We are both interested in intergenerational learning, how we can all learn from each other. In fact, I gave a keynote recently to a higher education institution in New Jersey for a student support staff retreat. There were about 200 people there. The focus was on building a culture where students can reach their potential. And I referenced your work, talked about your book, and emphasized, you know, generational differences, because that's kind of what they wanted me to make sure I included. So I've just got some questions for you, and we'll just dive in. What do you think?
Sounds great.
Okay. Well, there are currently five generations in the workforce. We hear that a lot. How do you define generation? And for our listeners, briefly describe the five generations so that we're all on the same page.
Sure. So my preference in terms of thinking about generation is as a layer of your identity. So of course, we're talking about people who are born in a common period of history to you. Generations are, no pun intended, an age-old phenomenon where we look at formative events that we believe commonly shape a particular cohort of people. So usually it's people born within 15 to 20 years of one another. And we use noteworthy formative events in culture and society and politics to note the beginning and end of a generation, that if people experience something during their most formative years together, we believe it creates sort of a commonality and a bond. So of course, the generations differ depending on where in the world we are. So it's always important to say that. But if we're talking about the US, right now there are six to seven generations in our population, but five in the workforce. So at the oldest end right now, we have our silent generation. And these are people born 1928 to 1945. So not too many of them are still choosing to be in the workplace, but there are still a few. Then of course, our baby boomer generation born 1946 to 1964, and lots to dig into there in terms of their choices about remaining in the workforce versus retirement and all the things that brings along with it. We have my generation, Gen X, which is 1965 to 1980, the much discussed millennial generation, 1981 to 1996. And then we have Gen Z, 1997 to tentatively 2012. So right now I'm actually working on something proposing that we extend the end date of Gen Z because of the pandemic being a sort of unifying formative event for that generation, making sure we don't leave out anyone who had sort of a school experience in the midst of the lockdown. And then the generation after Gen Z, which would be kids who are under the age of 10 right now, tentatively named Generation Alpha, but of course not yet in the workforce.
Right. Well, again, I kind of said this in the intro, and my listeners kind of know where I'm coming from with this saging, which is just another word for positive aging. But, you know, I'm focused on, you know, why is there ageism? Why is age kind of held against us? I'm saying there's a lot of wisdom and life experience, and we'll kind of get into that. But, you know, the boomer stuff, I often say I'm out to help boomers figure out what to do with the rest of their lives, because it is, you know, so, and I always look at work as contribution. Work could be paid, not paid, volunteer, part-time, full-time, encore career, you know, all of these, but there is ageism. And so maybe we'll get into some of that. So that's where I'm kind of coming from. And I'm very interested in your work. And I think what a great niche you have here. Well, based on your research, what are the tensions or conflicts that emerge in the workplace as a result of these generations? And again, I know you could write a book on that, but, you know, what are some of the primary issues that workplaces and leaders are now dealing with?
Sure. So the research would support that if we just leave multi-age, multi-generational workforces to their own devices, which largely we have when it comes to things like age, we will get tension and frustration. So it's not imaginary that we feel like this is a tense situation. Gentelligence, which as you mentioned is the name of my book, is a term that I came up with a few years ago to really challenge us to change the way we're viewing this. So yes, we currently and without effort look at it as a frustration, but could we reframe it as something positive, full of potential and opportunity? So I know we'll get to that, but in terms of where the natural tension stems from, you know, a lot of it is we are operating from sort of an us versus them mentality. And it comes from a couple of places. You know, one of the roadblocks we talk about in our book, we talk about four. One is generational scapegoating and shaming, right? So okay boomer being a perfect example, mm-hmm. entitled millennial, slacker Gen X, Gen sure. Z snowflake, you know, you give me a generation, we have an insult about it. And so somehow we've normalized in our society this idea that it's fine to be putting down other people based on their generation, which of course is a form of identity or a layer of identity that people have no control over, right? You don't have a say in your age. And so somehow we've given a pass to sort of this ageist idea. And I look at ageism, of course, in terms of bias against people of older age, but also younger age. Anytime you're basically making assumptions about someone based on their age, it's ageism. So that's the second roadblock is ageism and bias, right? So stereotypes. We don't tend to in the workplace interact with people that are much older or younger than us unless we're given an intentional reason to do so. And so because of that, we have this polarization. If I don't know anyone personally or well who is 65 or who is 25, I'm 45, I'm going to make assumptions. I'm going to use stereotypes to fill in sort of, I'm going to be lazy and say, well, you know, kids these days, or okay, boomer, it's easy, right? And so that tends to create this division that makes us feel like they're a them and we're an us. And of course, then we're in competition rather than in collaboration. And then the last two roadblocks we talk about, one is, and this is my favorite one, are myths about the differences we have in needs. So I always want to make sure I bring up, because I am an academic, that's my day job, right? That sure. A lot of people disconnect from a generational conversation because all they've heard is stereotypes. They've heard the clickbait, like the media headlines about, you know, things that when they hear about their own generation, they tune out and they say, that's not me. That's just a bunch of stereotypes. And so there's actually great research that looks at the fact that generations, regardless of age, we all have common needs. So, you know, the people who say, let's get rid of generational categories, we're all just the same deep down. Yes and no. It's kind of like saying be colorblind, right? That's not quite enough. That's not quite good enough. But there is truth to the fact that we all have the same internal needs for things like respect and connection and autonomy. But where we get kind of hung up and have challenges is that the norms we've learned to fulfill those needs differ depending on when we grew up. So if we think, for example, about you, when you started your career, how you were taught to earn respect in the workplace or what it meant to pay your dues, right? That there's probably different norms than I learned and different norms than my son is learning, right? Who's a teenager. And so The need for earning respect or to show competency is the same, but the, you know, idea that we get hung up on the behavior and we don't actually dig into the need underneath it is creating the roadblock. And then finally, the last roadblock we talk about are sort of knowledge differences and attention, right? So if an organization is telling me that we really need people with more digital savvy, and that tends to be most associated with our younger generations, of course, that's threatening to me because I think, well, if what they know is so important, is what I know not important? So as you said, your idea that sages, and of course, historically, the wisdom that comes from age, that kind of got flipped upside down in a really uncomfortable way with the digital revolution, where suddenly younger people knew things older people didn't. And we just didn't really know what to do about that. And instead of thinking, well, great, we have different kinds of expertise, we can learn from each other, we somehow created this memo that was a threat. And so that can create some tension as well.
You know, outstanding. This is really excellent. And what I discovered, because my background is higher education, I spent 30 years teaching business management and leadership at a small private arts college in Iowa. But what I discovered, and I'd be interested to see what you think about this, is I too made the assumption that students know a whole lot more about, younger students know a whole lot more about technology than I do. So occasionally I'd run into a snag. And I'd say to this, you know, I'm trying to show a YouTube clip in class or trying to do something. I'd run into a snag and I'd say, okay, who can help me here? And anyway, long story short is I kind of came to the conclusion that they know a lot about, in terms of technology, it's wide, but not very deep is what I discovered. Because, you know, I just kind of assumed they knew everything about technology, but that wasn't really true. You know, I do know something too. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, so that's a good, you know, point to bring up, because one of the biggest, I think, sore spots when I talk to older generations is the stereotype that they aren't good at technology, right? That they're technological dinosaurs. Yeah. And, you know, a lot of my clients will say, I created the technology that everybody's so sure I don't know how to use, right? So it is a stereotype. It's not a supported stereotype that older people can't learn technology, but there's fascinating differences there. So first of all, what we know is younger people tend to rely on what's called fluid knowledge. So fluid knowledge is what's the newest thing, what's like kind of a taster, like you said, like I want to try this new tool, this new technology, this new website, this new whatever it is. It's fun, it's interesting. I'm interested in sort of whatever the new thing is, if it's better than what I'm doing right now. And so because obviously in the point in time we're in, technology is changing so quickly, they have, and of course we're trying not to stereotype, this is a group level trend, they're more interested in it being pervasive, right? That there could be a new tool that will make things easier and better in different areas of my life. I'm willing to try it. Older people are just as able to use technology, but where it differs is we tend to rely on what's called crystallized knowledge. Like I figured out what works for me. That's what I do. That's what I know. That's what I like. If something isn't working, I'm more than willing to learn something new. But I don't necessarily need technology to be everywhere. I don't need a tool to do something that I already feel like I do just fine. The learning curve might be longer because it's not a natural sort of skill or knowledge we learned growing up. It was an acquired skill, right? We're digital immigrants, we call it, instead of digital natives. We're more than capable of learning and mastering that technology, but we may not want to. Or we may be more selective, or we may say, that's not what I use technology for. Mm-hmm. Whereas younger people, absolutely, they're more interested in sort of seeing what it can do and trying it out. And I've had the same experience. I all the time ask my students to help me with tech issues. But what's really unique, Jan, is that it's fairly rare for someone who's older to feel comfortable asking younger people to help. Right? You and I were fine to do it. I would say all the time, like, can someone please tell me why this Zoom link is not working? Like when I went remote for the pandemic, Yes. You know, we had to get up to speed in like 5 minutes on Zoom. And I just said to my students, because it was very natural for me, guys, I have done the best I can. I think we're good. I'm going to need your help. We're in this together, because I believe that makes them respect me more when I'm willing to ask for their help and I'm interested in their input. I'm interested in learning from them. And this is a really key Gentelligence concept. Is there's this misperception, particularly with older people, and Gentelligence is about championing all generations, but particularly with us people who are older, we tend to think, I can't ask for help. I'm supposed to know how to do it. And if I do, I'm going to look stupid, or they're going to look down on me as a dinosaur. But I actually find when I say to them, okay, guys, like, why is this not working? Someone, you know, I'm phoning a friend, someone help me out. Particularly younger generations are so interested in having input and voice and contributing, right? That's a very important norm for them. And creating those openings for them to engage and contribute builds respect with them. And they're actually much more willing and interested to listen to your input and mentoring if you've first been willing to listen to them, which isn't surprising, but I think we forget that.
Yeah. No, I think that's a very good point. And again, you know, I'd been teaching 30 years and, you know, people kind of knew who I was. So I wasn't hesitant. Well, in the back of my mind, I would think, oh, they're going to think, you know, I really don't know how to do this. But I think I also had confidence that I know a lot of things they don't know. And so, you know, it was, like you said, we can all learn from each other. One question that I often get asked, and I've done some research on this, Megan, so I'd be interested in your opinion, but the whole concept, the perception of loyalty, tell me if this is correct, because this is what I've read, that younger people may, you know, when I graduated, and I'm definitely older than you are, but when I graduated, you did not want to be a job hopper. You didn't want to move around very much. I mean, you wanted to move up, and if that involved after a few years moving on, fine, but people nowadays, they don't give a second thought. But what I've read is, as long as they're there, they are very loyal. It's just that, you know, the job market has changed and the great resignation and all of that. Well, what's your perception on loyalty with maybe millennials or younger?
So definitely, and even before the great resignation and the pandemic, we were hearing this, right? Millennials are fickle, they're entitled, they lack loyalty. I think there's a couple layers of things, Jan. One is, you know, the research actually shows millennials weren't job hopping anymore during their sort of 20s and 30s than Gen X was. So there was a study done on that we referenced in the book, which we were really surprised by. But I think what people were picking up on was the fact that millennials were much more vocal. About what they needed, why they were leaving, what they were looking for instead, right? Where maybe Gen X was just sliding out under the radar, right? So that was really interesting. But I think it comes down to a couple things. I think we definitely have seen a decrease in sort of the norm that we owe it to an organization to stay. I think particularly the silent generation, and then to some extent with the boomers, but not entirely, there was the societal norm that whoever gave you your start or your break, like you were going to stay there, you were going to work your way up the ladder, you were going to retire from there and get your watch or your clock or whatever it is. And that started to fade when people, I think particularly with my generation, we started thinking, you know, what's a career for? What is a job for? I want a job that has meaning. I want a job that has purpose. I want a job that gives me balance with my life. Which is where that slacker perception came from, right? That our parents' generation said, well, a job is to pay your mortgage. A job isn't to give you purpose in your life. That's what your family's for. That's what your friends are for. And my generation pushed back on that, right? Every generation kind of pushes back. And so we saw then this sort of decrease where the millennials were brought up with this mentality that their needs were very central and important. We gave them, and again, these are group level sort of narratives, but we gave them a strong voice. The millennials were the product of baby boomer work ethic. They wanted to create opportunities for their kids that maybe their parents hadn't been able to give them, and they were willing to work hard to do it. All came from a very positive place. So we started giving these kids classes and lessons and opportunities and development and investing in their self-esteem and trying to correct everything we thought should have been done differently for ourselves when we were kids. And the end product was the most developed, educated generation we had ever seen with the millennials. And so by the time they turned 18 and they're coming to our universities, they were much further along in terms of experiences, right? When I graduated high school, it was sort of like, I graduated high school, I had a decent ACT score, I got into a good college. Well, you know, in higher ed today, to get into a good college, you have to be mayor and cure world hunger. And, you know, there's so much pressure about what these kids have done and had leadership experiences and 6 years of piano and
or, you know, parents, Megan, or the parents who were trying to buy their kids way into school, which is terrible.
Well, and that, there's something there too, right? That's the dark side, I think, yes, of the helicopter parenting, where if you've invested so many resources and expectations into creating your children in this image you wish you could have had for yourself, it's very, yes, hard to cut those strings, right? And that's, yes, where that helicopter parenting came in. And of course, a whole other interview we could do around, you don't teach them to fail, you don't teach them to be self-directed, you don't, you know, and that's things, yes, that are sort of the dark side of that. But I think to get back to the fickle sort of job hopping, you know, I read this fascinating article in 2019, I think it was the New York Times, and it was called, you know, Young People Will Reimagine Office Life. And it had this quote that said, young people think of work as a thing, not a place. And so this idea that I can do it anywhere, I can do it from my house, I can do it from my office, I can do it, it's something I do, it's not necessarily who I am, is interesting. And then of course, with the pandemic and everything that has brought, I think we're seeing several generations. And if we think about Gen Z, who the oldest had just started their career when the pandemic hit, you know, they're learning that it's pretty risky to put all your eggs in one basket and count on any institution to see you through, that you need to be, and this is a difference between Gen Zs and millennials, is Gen Z is learning very quickly about risk and about being self-sufficient and, yes, not counting on, you know, whether it's an entity of any kind, whether it's the government or the health organization or your company, to have all the answers for you. And so I think they're really trying to make their own path. And so, you know, in a way, it's hard for organizations because you're not assuming people are going to come and stay. But it also, I think, raises the bar for organizations. And this is where, to me, Gentelligence comes in, is if you want to keep your best people, I don't care how old they are, they have to feel valued and heard and appreciated for what they bring. And so whether it's a baby boomer who maybe did work for the same company for 30 years and now post, you know, pandemic is saying, hey, I want to go somewhere where somebody appreciates my wisdom and my experience, not someplace where they're, you know, trying to slowly show me the door. You know, that, Jan, as I'm sure you know from your work, is this huge opportunity for companies that realize it. Like, let's get our baby boomers who still have 20 years more they want to work or 10 years more they want to work, but not in a place that's kind of discarded them, right? They want to work for somebody who values their unique kind of experience and expertise. That's going to be a huge source, I think, of talent potential.
Oh, I do too. And I think, one of the big silver linings, I think, of the pandemic is leaders have to wake up. No, I mean, I've been, you know, beating the servant leadership drum for decades, but I think finally leaders are going to have to pay attention to work, you know, to employees and really care, compassion, empathy, all of these soft skills that people like me have been advocating are the important skills have finally become front and center, I think. And that I find very rewarding. Well, that's excellent. Well, in your book, you outline four practices and activities to help move towards a better intergenerational kind of cooperation. Can you share those with us? Because what I find interesting and what I was talking about when I referenced your work in that talk is these practices are helpful beyond the workplace, you know, with friends and family. So maybe, you know, focus on the, like those four practices. So what should we be thinking about and doing?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's true. We did. So Gentelligence was featured in Harvard Business Review in March as their big idea. And one of the revisions we were doing, we had like 15 rounds of revisions. One of the editors said, well, how is this different than just good leadership? Which I loved because I'm like, it's not, right? Yeah. Per your point.
Right.
It works for everything, but here's just a particular area we're asking people to apply it to. So the four practices are pulled from really best practices in both DE&I and also cross-cultural management. So anytime you're working across difference, basically. Mm-hmm. So the first one is identifying assumptions. So there's two levers to that we have sort of explored. The first is the most obvious, which is stereotypes, right? So we recommend a really easy tool for people to do who are listening is your own assumption audit. So sort of making the implicit biases you have more explicit for yourself. So spending this week, for example, and paying attention for you, but also like when you're in meetings with your team or in other places, where are people making age-based assumptions? So an example I have of this, I was on the phone with a client who was talking about rolling out a new upskilling training program. And I said, great, like who's the target audience for this? Like how many, you know, people do you think are going to be involved? And they said, everybody but our baby boomers, which you can imagine I had that same reaction. Yeah. So she winced. For, I know we don't have video on this, but... I said, whoa, 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 because this wasn't a Gentelligence call. So I said, whoa, 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 what, let's back up. Like, why are we not offering it? First of all, like age discrimination, but why are we not offering this to our older workers? Well, you know, I was talking to someone in the coffee room and they said they sure hope they didn't have to take part in that. You know, this idea that like they don't, and I said, okay, well, we're not going to make strategy decisions based on one person, right? And second right. of all, you know, lack of development opportunities is a huge reason older people want to leave, right? They don't feel like anyone's interested in developing them further. And it's a stereotype that they're not interested in doing that. So where do you see those assumptions, you know, in terms of stereotypes? And then the second like layer of that is also, what are you assuming everyone sees the same way? So when you said the word, you know, loyalty, or you say the word independence or balance or, you know, flexibility, what does that mean to somebody who's 30 versus somebody who's 60? And are you assuming it, everyone's defining it the same way? So that leads into our second practice, which is called adjust the lens. Mm-hmm. So we see things the way we are, right? So when I think about what is the correct behavior at work or the way we're going to do something. Of course, it's colored by all the different layers of my identity and my experience, but I might not realize it. Mm-hmm. So I'm judging your way of doing it as wrong because it's not my way, right? That's sort of human nature 101. So the question of when you see something that strikes you as potentially a generational tension or conflict, pausing and saying, okay, what is the behavior? What interpretation am I making of it? And is there another way to see it? So just a quick story. I had a workshop where a woman was talking about how rude it was that people were pulling out phones in a meeting. Because to her, that meant they were distracted. They weren't paying attention. And she had immediately jumped to that assumption. And so adjusting her lens, I just asked her coworkers, like, is there another explanation she's not thinking about, right? Some of them were just, you know, probably sure. being rude, but a lot of them said, oh, I take notes on my phone all the time. Well, she didn't, right? That's just not something she felt she needed her phone for, but it hadn't occurred to her that there could be another explanation. So mm-hmm. where can you adjust your lens so that you're not reacting to a behavior that's strange to you as offensive or wrong? Right. Yeah. And the phrase, you know, I like to leave a quick tool with each practice. So the tool I like to leave with that one is, can you help me understand? Right. Like I'll say, can you help me understand why we have all the laptops out? Like what's going on the laptops, right? And so then people can say, oh, I'm taking notes, or I have that website pulled up, or, you know, whatever it might be. And then the last two practices are really about how do we turn this from threat to opportunity? So once we sort of neutralize bias and tension, research shows there's a ton of potential on the other side. We can actually have higher employee engagement, higher retention, better performance, more innovation with an intergenerational workforce if we're actually taking proactive steps to create that. So the third practice is strengthening trust. So how do we make it so that I trust that you and I are on the same side, that we're aimed towards the same goal or mission, that we're not somehow in some, you know, locked into some sort of competition for resources or attention, and that we can ask each other for help and share our best ideas, right? That psychological safety mm-hmm. that we know is so important. Yes. My go-to tool on that one, if we go back to, you know, just you and I talking about struggling with technology, is how would you do this, right? So I'll often say, whether it's to my students or younger colleagues, here's what I want to do. Here's my vision. How would you do it? And again, you're inviting input, and you don't have to do it that way. Nobody says you have to give over the keys to your kingdom or your company, but you're going to learn. You're showing that you're open to learning. And often, particularly with younger generations, what they want is a chance to give input, right? They want that voice. We think they expect then to get to make all the decisions. I haven't found that to be true. They just want to be heard like the rest of us. And then the final practice is what we call expand the pie, which is all about co-creation, mutual sort of win-win. The fact that learning from each other, intergenerational collaboration, is how we grow. And if we think about this like nebulous future of work, one generation isn't going to figure this out, right? We really do need all different kinds of expertise on deck in order to figure out what we do next and how, what you know, what's our next move here. And that means everyone needs to feel like their input is being valued. So those are the four practices in a nutshell.
Yeah, no, that's excellent. And as you said, you know, your Harvard Business Review article titled Harnessing the Power of Age Diversity is excellent. And I also, I don't know if I said this earlier, Megan, but I also enjoyed I heard you on the Idea, what is it, IdeaCast podcast? Mm-hmm. Yeah, yep. No, that was excellent. Well, we're kind of running out of time. We could talk forever. Maybe we'll do a part two, you know? But I did want to kind of ask this question. First of all, I encourage everyone listening to go to your TED Talk, which is, I mentioned it, it's titled Why I Love Millennials and You Should Too. Well, tell us, give us a sneak peek. Why do you love millennials and why should we too?
You know, I think it really does come from the fact that they, and as a generation, of course, they've maybe had the hardest time of anyone just being, you know, the blamed for change, right? Mm-hmm. If things are changing too fast, we point our finger at younger generations. If we don't feel they're changing fast enough, we point it at older generations. You know, the time I did that, millennials were really causing people to tear their hair out. And I, you know, they represent a very large part of our workforce now, the largest part of our workforce, and have a very different lens on the world, and one that I think we can learn a lot from, right? I mean, I love the energy. I learn a ton from younger people, whether they're millennials or Gen Z, mm-hmm. By asking them. Again, it's really stepping away from stereotypes. You know, I view, whereas they're viewed as entitled because they're asking for things or they're raising their hand, I view that as being proactive. Mm-hmm. And just like anything else, how you view it has a lot to do with how you interact or lead or have the ability to learn from someone. So I love millennials. I love all generations, Jan, to be fair. I love all generations. But I think when it comes to our younger people, such a source of energy and you know, innovation, a new perspective. Yes, they need mentoring, just like I need mentoring. They need feedback, they need experience, but they have their own experience and expertise. So it really was a pushback that somehow, you know, they were something to be dealt with or something to be you know, intimidated by, and said, saying, how lucky are we that we have an entire generation of people we've invested so fully in. Let's listen to what they had to say, and let's learn, I think, collectively and together.
Yeah. No, I love that, Megan. It's wonderful. So I encourage people to go watch the TEDx. Well, I always like to ask interviewees, what else should my listeners know that I did not ask? In other words, what other words of wisdom would you like to share?
Oh, goodness. You know, that's such a fascinating one. I think for me, it's really about changing the conversation, right? You know, so I always say leadership is about seeing as an opportunity what other people see as a threat. And insert whatever, you know, topic you want in there. And so what is the opportunity now? You know, we can't put the genie back in the bottle when it comes to how we lead and manage people. And so how can we do it in a way that's going to benefit everyone, right? How do we view this as an opportunity to tap into the ideas, the thoughts of people who've been working for 50 years and people who've been working for 5 minutes, and say, how do we do this better, right? We get to rewrite the entire book on what work is and the role it plays in our life. Like, let's not waste that opportunity, right? So I think generational learning and collaboration is going to be such a huge part of getting it right this time around.
Yeah. Well, I think you're onto something that you'll be able to utilize in your work and research and everything for decades. So I'm very impressed. And honestly, there's so many things that I would like to ask you that I'm really serious about a part two, Megan. Okay.
Okay. So all right.
My focus in this series is to help people make the rest of life the best of life. So may the rest be the best for you.
Thank you.